Blog Talk Radio.
And now, on the African American Athlete Sports Network, it's Express Yourself with host T. Ramone and Sko.
Express Yourself!
It's an hour packed with guests, opinions, sports news of the day, and off-the-field issues that impact play on it. And you, the listeners, will have an opportunity to express yourself on our call-in line as well. Now here's our Express Yourself hosts, veteran sports journalists Tim Turner and Roscoe Nance.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Express Yourself with T. Ramone and Sko. I'm Tim Turner, and along with my guest host, Roscoe Nance, we'll be here just trying to have an hour of opinions and interviews and fun and just to kick around the things that have been happening in the sports world. You know, we had another, you know, it's always the same until, I guess, through February of next year that we're going to have a really great weekend of football, and this weekend was no exception. So we're excited about that. They were big games. We're going to look back at the big games, look ahead at the ones that are coming this weekend. And also tonight, we have with us a college football coaching legend as our guest. So I'm excited about the show today. And Roscoe, how are you doing, sir?
Hello?
I think I lost my co-host for a second there, but I just wanted to know that tonight you guys can call us and with your opinion and your take. So you can give us a call at 929-477-1209. Again, that number is 929-477-1209. And like I said, we just had a great weekend of football and pros in college, and we have a legend with us tonight. Roscoe, how are you feeling?
I'm doing great. Just another day in paradise, and looking forward to another great show and interesting conversation with a very, very interesting coach, Willie Jeffries, you know, a true icon, a living legend, and a throwback to the old school coaches. He's quite a guy.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I know we don't want to belabor too much tonight on that, on the introduction and everything that's going forward. Coach Jeffries, he's said he's a legend. He coached at South Carolina State, coached at Howard, and was the first African-American to get a head coaching job at a D1 school when he was at Wichita State. So we want to bring him on this evening. Coach Jeffries, you there?
Yes, I am, Tim.
Hey, how are you doing, sir?
Hello, I didn't hear that. You were talking like a Morehouse guy.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
I didn't hear you go. Ask me that again, please.
I was just saying, how you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing fine, and thanks to you and Roscoe for being on your show.
Well, Coach, let's just get to it and just talk about, you know, your role in history and becoming the first black coach at a Division I program and how that came about and what it was like.
Well, what I do is for young coaches now, I tell them not when they graduate, not to go out and start working if they want to do a career in coaching. Stay on and be a graduate assistant because it's so hard to go from a high school coach to D1 or any university as an assistant coach. So what we do, we tell them to stay on as a GA, which is a graduate assistant. Learn more football, get a master's degree, and sooner or later, a coach on that present staff will get a head job, and you go along as an assistant. Now you're in college football. It happened, I think Dave One said at the University of Pittsburgh was one example I use. He was a starting tackle for us at Pitt. He graduated, and in lieu of him going out to coach in high school, I convinced him to stay on as a graduate assistant. Jimmy Johnson, who was an assistant coach there, got the job at Oklahoma State in just 2 years, so he took Dave with him. in about 3 or 4 years, Jimmy Johnson was head coach at the University of Miami. He took Dave with him. Later on, Jimmy is head coach of the Dallas Cowboys. He took Dave with him. Later on, Dave is head coach of the Chicago Bears. After he was released from the Bears, Jimmy was head coach of the Miami Dolphins. Jimmy went out and they gave the job to Dave Wannstedt. What I tell especially young black college football players, stay on as a graduate assistant. Now, my job, my role to Division I was much different. I just stayed at South Carolina State until someone called, noting our success at South Carolina State. They called from Wichita State, and I went out there as head coach. Now, I say this about Wichita State. They were inclined to hire a black coach. John Merritt of Tennessee State had turned the job down. He was in his comfort level at Tennessee State. Rudy Hubbard at Florida A&M turned the job down. He was in a comfort level at Florida A&M. So someone had to do it, Tim, you and Roscoe. Someone had to break the glass ceiling. So I'm the guy who picked my family up in January, mid-year, and moved to Wichita, Kansas to break that glass ceiling so that there could be a head football coach that was black in major college football.
So in doing that, what were some of the trials and tribulations that you went through?
Well, Roscoe, you and I have discussed this. It's so easy with the Rooney Rule or without the Rooney Rule for a black person to be hired as a head coach in the National Football League, because there's one person who has to make that decision. That's the owner. In college football, you've got boosters. Those boosters that give millions of dollars, and they have a say-so in who you hire, and it's usually not going to be a black head coach. We had a booster at Wichita State who was given $3 to $4 to $5 million a year to athletics, and he said if they hired me, he would withdraw his support. They hired me anyway.
Wow.
And, of course, later on, this same guy who owned 42 Pizza Huts in the United States, sooner or later he became one of my best boosters, but he did not like the idea of them hiring a black head coach. But later on he came around. So you see, on the college level, it's much more difficult because there are so many people. The director of athletics, the president, and when they check with their people who give a lot of money, they've got to clear it with them. So that's why it's so tough in college ball. Fortunately, the president of Wichita State, Dr. Clark Allbird, with an A, he said, we're going to hire for success at Wichita State. So they hired me, and of course, the rest is history.
So how were you able to navigate, you know, the issues with the alumni? And, well, I know you have a great personality, and it's hard for anybody who talks to you not to like you. You know, you can charm, you're just a charmer. So how did you navigate that?
Well, Roscoe, it was tough, first of all, to attract a good athlete to the plains of Kansas. Now, back to the people in Kansas, they were very kind, good people. All of the other boosters, other than that one guy, they rallied around me. I had 39 boosters who owned their own airplanes, because Wichita State, which I didn't know, is the small aircraft capital of the world, the Cessna airplanes, and they made two other brands. So when I would go out to recruit an athlete, white or black, I got good acceptance from the family. And we were able to be successful, 8-3 on my third season. But the only athlete who refused me was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We were sitting there having hot chocolate and cookies. Mother and father were very nice people, his sisters and brothers. And this young man came out about midways the visit and said, I cannot vision myself playing under a black head coach. He said, no problem with you, Coach Jeffries, but I cannot because I have a midget ball, elementary school, high school. I've had white coaches. So what did I tell him? I said, son, I'm happy to find out before 4th and 1. Everybody laughed, and that was the gist of it. But to sum it up, we had the people in Wichita, Kansas, and all around in Oklahoma, alumni people in Oklahoma, Texas, and Kansas were very kind to us. My problem, I knew, would be to attract good athletes to the plains of Kansas.
Well, when you look at the landscape, Division 1A today, and the number of black coaches, are you encouraged, discouraged with what's going on? What are your thoughts about it?
Well, you know, sometimes no matter how well you do, you're not accepted, and people just feel like the guy who made the statements, I think somewhere in Minnesota, he said, you just can't depend on a black quarterback. And he might have lost his job of Texas. So you see how people feel, especially about the quarterback position, even after Doug Williams won the Super Bowl. It's an innate quality that some people feel. But, you know, there are some places that will accept a black head coach and feel that he can hire a good staff and that they're good coaches. But it's so sad nationally that you still have people that, as that guy put it, that when it comes down to the clutch, you know, you just can't depend on a black head coach. So that those are his feelings, and probably he just has an innate feeling that black coaches are inferior. So we put up with that. I look at the head coaches now in Division I football, and it's much better than it used to be. I think after I was hired, the guy Dennis Green was hired at Northwestern 2 years after I was retired. And when Dennis left Northwestern, Francis Pay, P-E-A-Y, Francis Pay was hired at Wisconsin. Then you had Wayne Nunnally at UNLV, and you had about three or four other guys, maybe 4 years after the Wichita State hiring. So that opened the door, and the weight, Roscoe, as you and I discussed, the weight was kind of off my shoulders when we came up with the 8-3 season in 1982.
Well, Coach, I know there was an article in USA Today. I don't think he got a lot of play, where the writer Paul Marburg was writing, and he talked to did a survey, and he talked to several Division I coaches, you know, about the most overrated coaches, and three of the nine coaches that were mentioned were black. David Shaw at Stanford, Willie Taggart at Florida State, and James Franklin at Penn State. And, of course, these were, you know, coaches were, you know, anonymous. And I know that struck a nerve with you.
Yes, it did. And I look at David Shaw, and Willie Taggart hasn't even had a chance to Florida State is at a low ebb as far as talent is concerned. And I look at James Franklin, who's doing a tremendous job at Penn State. And they were saying that the guy at Stanford was thinks that he's God's gift to football. Those are prejudice remarks, I think, when you talk about the overrated coaches. I guess the other six were white coaches, but for them to make a statement like that and to look at the success Stanford has had, and Willie Taggart hasn't even had a chance yet, even if he's 1-3 or 0-4, whatever, he's he has just gotten there. And then James Franklin doing a great job at Penn State of all the problems they've had. O'Brien, Coach O'Brien after Paterno did a great job. And then James Franklin came in and just cemented that team into winning. So those are just statements that we have to put up, and we still see that people have certain feelings about black head coaches.
Well, you know, I think some of that might just be based in jealousy, you know, that these guys were able to get, you know, those jobs. I mean, you're talking about, you know, three really high-profile jobs, and that, you know, in years past it would have been unheard of for a black to even be, you know, considered for it, to interview for it, let alone get the job and to be to have some success in those kinds of positions.
Well, you're right about that. They're high profile schools that they were hired. Now, I was interviewed at Ohio State, and John Cooper, a friend of mine, got the job because he had taken Arizona State to the Rose Bowl. The high profile schools. Well, let's go back to when I was hired. Wichita State, we had to play three money games because we, in going into Division One, we had the seating capacity in the stadium, the number one criteria. You have to seat 30,000 or better. We cleared that. You had to average 22,000 at home. We cleared that. And you had to have the maximum number of scholarships allowed by the NCAA. We cleared that. So when I was hired, and then at Northwestern, they weren't doing all that well. Dennis Green was hired. Miami of Ohio, Cleve Bryant was hired. And then at UNLV, they were noted for basketball. The same really as Wichita State was known for basketball and baseball. Then Wayne Nunley was hired because he was an alumnus. He played football at UNLV. So the first round of hiring, they were at low-profile schools. And we played Alabama. We played Tennessee. We played Arizona State. And those were money games. I'm the only guy who head coached against Bear Bryant and Eddie Robinson, which is you could see that had to be a coach from a predominantly black school. So the first round of hiring were at low-profile schools, and we had to prove that we could coach on that level, even playing the schedules that we played.
I wanted to, for a hot second, wanted to just let folks know that y'all can call in and talk to Coach Jeffries and share your opinions at 929-477-1209. And I think we have a caller in from the 410 area code. We want to just check and see who that is. 410, could you just give us your name and where are you calling from? Hello? 410.
Yeah, evidently they must have hung up.
Coach, this is the question I have for you in terms of, you've mentioned James Franklin over at Penn State, and that was a great game Saturday night against Ohio State. And the last series, last time Penn State had the ball, they ran into some difficulty. The play that they ran was a play a lot of folks wouldn't have run. And their coach caught a great deal, or frankly caught a lot of heat this week. And do you think it puts him in that much more pressure on a guy like him when he fails in a situation like that? Even with the program as successful as Penn State is, when he fails in a situation like that against Ohio State, it seems like it always comes back to, you know, somebody else would have made a different call.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. I was there for that game. Coach Franklin is a friend of mine. I was there for that football game. I was at State College, went there on Friday, and the four Ohio State scored all their touchdowns on one play. It was a screen pass. Coach Franklin and his staff decided to run number 8. They had a little running back in there, and they had a fourth down. and they ran a quick trap, and all night that the Ohio State had been jamming that hole up. It was a chance they figured Ohio State would be playing pass, that the defensive lineman would be running upfield to rush the passer, and the trap would have popped for a long yardage. That was just a call, and I also know he's getting a lot of flack about when to go for one and when to go for two. But that happens in football all the time, and I must say that the play call would, after it was unsuccessful, you know, had that play popped, like the offensive coordinator at Penn State thought it would have, then they would have been heroes. It would have been a great call, great coach, but it just didn't work. And then it became a questionable call because it was unsuccessful. And we can all say that could have been a questionable call because number eight, he had only gained 43 yards the whole night, but one was a one-yard touchdown run that he made. So we're going to have those, and especially when it's a black head coach, it's going to magnify. And fortunately, I was at that game, and they set a record, 110,963 people attended that game. But still, great questions about the calls. And I do think they were magnified because James Franklin is an African-American.
Well, Coach, let me ask you this.
Like your question, too.
let me ask you this one, Coach. You know, you came from an HBCU to Division One, to Division 1A. Now there are no other black coaches coming, you know, traveling from that pad. Why is that, and do you see that changing?
Well, first of all, I think it'll change, but that coach has to be a coach that will be willing to leave out of his comfort zone because they're not going to identify the black head coach if he's not winning a lot of games at his present school. So that coach has to make a decision, like John Merritt and Rudy Hubbard, as to whether or not they want to leave and take that chance to go to 1A, because he said, I can stay here and win 8 or 9 games a year and be comfortable. So I think it'll change, but there has to be a coach at a school where he's winning and he's willing to advance himself in coaching college football in the 1A division.
Well, I think, you know, the attitude and the way that black college football is viewed today is a little bit different than when you came along. I don't know if it's held in as high regard today as it was back then. I think, this is just my opinion, that, you know, when you were coaching, when, you know, Eddie, Big John, and the like, that, you know, winning at an HBCU, you know, really meant something. And I think the coaches now that are winning, they would gladly take a Division 1A job if somebody came around and offered it. But I don't know if those schools, you know, put as much value on winning at an HBCU today as they did back in the day.
No, I think you're correct. Now, the college coaching is getting better in all levels. Even your high school coaches are good technicians in teaching the fundamentals of football. They're going to clinics. They're getting better. But back in the day, your Gramlins and Tennessee States and even our school at South Carolina State, we were winning, and they valued that because one reason was that we had good athletes back then. They couldn't I don't know if I could have recruited a Harry Carson or Donnie Shell or Charlie Brown or Robert Porche, because we had those athletes, and black college football was valued. They didn't take in under consideration that, hey, this coach is so successful, he's a great coach. They didn't know that we had the top players, but they valued the HBCUs and their programs. Now they know that the five-chip, four-chip, a four-star, five-star players, they know that we're not going to get them. And so now they think that we are playing with second-rate players, so they just don't value HBCU college football. And I will say that most coaches don't even go out until the 1As have made their picks, and they go to Florida and Georgia and different places to find their speed, and they go other places to find linemen, but they don't even try. And I think that's one reason they don't value black college football as much nowadays as they used to, because they think that the competition is great, because an A&T can get the same player that a Grambling gets. It's a relative. I call it relative, because out of that next pool, you go for it. So, see, you're all recruiting from the same pool. The four-star guys are gone, and the three-star guys, they're gone. So you're still recruiting from that same pool, and you have a chance. But as you said, Roscoe, it's not valued at all because of the caliber of athletes we get. And what they don't know, we have a linebacker taken in the second round at Indianapolis. He's leading the NFL in tackles. But we discussed this, Roscoe. We only have one or two. Well, most of the time we are blessed with one guy like that, where a bowl division team would have four or five like that. So that's the kind of the answer to that question, is how they look at black college football today.
Well, you're talking about Darius.
Now, do you feel a sense of pride for when you see a guy like a David Shaw at a major program like Stanford, which is perennially a top 25 school, or you see somebody like that, or Franklin over there at Penn State, where these guys are generally in the conversation for the national championship, that you had something to do with them getting there?
Oh, Tim, I feel great. I feel great. And even the young coach at Notre Dame, I thought he got a raw deal. He would always see me and say, "Coach, thank you for opening the door." We played Alabama in 1979 down in Tuscaloosa. And the guy who became head coach at Mississippi State, he was an Alabama guy.
He was a graduate assistant.
Sylvester Croom.
What was his name again?
Sylvester Croom.
Well, anyway, during that ball game, to show you how black coaches are, Sylvester Croom was a graduate assistant at Alabama, and he told the newspaper reporter, he said, "That whole game, I was trying to do my job that Coach Bryant had me doing, but I could not take my eyes off of Coach Jeffries." Now, here's the first black head coach on the other sideline. I wanted to see his demeanor. I just wanted to check him out to see what he's doing and how he handles himself and how he does with his players. So Sylvester Croom came up, became the head coach at Mississippi State. And I just think that you have a whole lot of coaches that would take that jump if they offered.
No doubt. And the coach at Notre Dame.
And also, Tim, I do have I take pride when I see even the guy at Texas A&M, we were pulling for him so hard. Now he's at another school. But
Kevin Sumlin.
When a black head coach is at a Stanford or a Penn State, you have to pull hard, because they've got to win or go, and you know that all eyes are upon them to see how well they do. But they do have a chance, because they're at a good school with a good reputation, and they've got the same chance as all other coaches have in order to go out and recruit.
So how
you
difficult
got a,
is
in Arizona
it
has both of the state schools have black head coaches. You got Sumlin is at Arizona, and
the former
Arizona
Herm
State
Edwards.
Herm Edwards is at Arizona State. So you got both of those guys running the programs in Arizona. So, you know, hats off to the state there.
Well, Coach, how difficult is it for you to do your job when you know all eyes are on you like that? I mean,
well, you know, I didn't realize it, Roscoe, when I took the job. And once I got there and the newspaper people started calling, I started getting letters from black, even basketball coaches writing. Nolan Richardson, the guys who was at Tulsa, started dropping a note. And finally I realized that, boy, I'm carrying a lot of weight on my shoulders because, you know, we're the only – and let's look at this in reality. We are probably the only race of people where we're judged by one or two incidents. And I hate to say that, but it's that way. And you come down to major college football, they're going to judge you by one or two things. Well, one thing is whether you win or not and whether you run a quality program. So it is very tough. That people look at it that way, but that's just the way it is.
So, Coach, you know, there are, you know, comparatively speaking, there are quite a number of black coaches in Division I today compared to when you were coaching. And those guys, they kind of have a network, a support system, you know, that they can call each other and talk about things. But you didn't have that. I mean, there was nobody else in the world that you could call and ask, you know, that was a Division I, a black football coach, and talk about what you were going through. So who did you talk to?
Well, the only guy I could talk to was Nolan Richardson. He was a basketball coach at Tulsa, and we talked. We'd go down into the bathroom and look under the stalls to be sure no one was in there, and we talked of. We talk in general about our support, our boosters. But let me say this. I had no one to talk to because I had no one who could make a comparison because there weren't any guys that had gone before me. So I'll say it like this. One advantage of getting old is that you don't have any peer pressure. See, the older you get, you don't have any peer pressure. All of them are dead. So, see, I had no one to discuss things. And what I decided to do was run a quality program. I went back to the basics, teaching the fundamentals of football, not doing a whole lot of stuff that people want to see, throwing a lot of passes. We went back to basics, and that's when we invented the freeze option offense that are so many of your major colleges put in at Syracuse, Florida State, East Carolina. We were the talk of the town with a new offense, and we get credit now for inventing an offense. So that added to our success, our knowledge of the game of football.
So what exactly, you know, is the freeze option? How did that work?
Well, all we did, we changed the track of the fullback to when you dive the fullback in and the quarterback pulls it and he goes out to the end and he challenges that end. If that end comes to him, he pitches the ball. If the end goes upfield, he keeps it and he ducks up the field for 12, 15 yards. We changed the track of the fullback. The old track that the fullback ran when you gave him the ball or you faked him to go to the perimeter, he ran to the outside foot of the guard. That was the track in all of your option football, the wishbone and everything. We had our track was the zero hole. He ran straight up the middle because the quarterback had to step back at 1 o'clock in lieu of stepping back at 12 o'clock. Because if he had stepped back at 12, he would have bumped heads with the fullback. Because the fullback's track is the zero hole of the center, right? And we found out that when you use that track straight up the middle, the linebackers bit onto it, so we had a clear field to go out. And once we challenged the end, if he went upfield, the quarterback would cut upfield, and the linebacker said locked onto the fullback. So we changed the track of the fullback, and if you dive your fullback to the outside foot of the guard, those linebackers, they out there a man further that he can help on the quarterback. And they thought so much, so well of that. We went to Syracuse and we put it in. We went to East Carolina, we put it in. We put it in at Florida State through Art Baker. Art was a coach, assistant coach at Florida State. He knew me well, so I went over it with him. So that goes to show you, and I hope that we gain some respect as coaches when we were able to invent a brand new offense. And it made me feel good. I was at a clinic in Binghamton, New York, cold out there, but they have a huge high school clinic out there, maybe 200 or 300 high school coaches. And they had a guy from Michigan there talking about their option. And when the guy got up, he said, listen, coaches, he said, there's a guy sitting right over there, Coach Jeffries, that should be making this lecture. He said, but all I'm going to do is talk to you about how we run the option. But when you hear him, he knows all of the intricacies of running option football. So we found out that coaches around the country knew that we knew how to run the option as well as anybody in 1A football.
Well, that's great.
And let me, Tim and Roscoe, let me say this too on my getting the job at Wichita. Gil Brandt, who was one of the top scouts in America, was with the Dallas Cowboys. Dick Mansberger, one of the top college scouts for the NFL in football, was working at Dallas. Ted Bradyhoff, who was the athletics director at Wichita State, had worked with those two guys. And when Ted started looking for the most successful black head football coach he could find, after Rudy Hubbard and John Merritt turned it down, I was on their list. They recommended me to Ted Bradyhoff at Wichita State. And when they flew down in one of those many King Air planes they had, he came down to talk with me. Then I showed some interest, and that was how I was able to get that job, because of people watching you. I tell young black high school coaches and college coaches and graduate assistants, when you don't think that their eyes upon you, that people are watching you, you're making a mistake. People are watching you at all times and making observations. So if you do your job, it'll be hard, but you'll get a chance.
This sound advice, Coach. This very sound advice. And we really want to thank you for coming on tonight and sharing your
Roscoe
story.
You all have to talk up a little bit. I can't hear you.
No, we're just saying we thank you for coming on our show tonight and sharing your story and just being, you know, the trailblazer and legend that you are.
Well, thank you, and thanks to Tim. And Tim, the only guy I met at Morehouse was Pinky Haynes. Pinky was the swimming guy.
Yeah.
I know you probably.
A legend.
Okay. And look, it's a pleasure being on your show, and feel free to call me at any time. Thanks a million.
Okay,
thank
Coach,
you,
thanks.
Sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah, that was Coach and Legend of Willie Jeffries, and he had just a wealth of knowledge, and it's information for guys who want to try to follow in his footsteps. And as Roscoe, as you noted, people really are making that jump from HBCUs to D1 like they used to, but nonetheless, he still gives you a clear path on how to do it.
Exactly, exactly. You know, great advice for those who are willing to listen and heed it. And who better to give that advice than the man who's been there?
Yeah, for sure. He gave us a lot of history on what happened to him and how he got the job. And he mentioned Nolan Richardson, and there's another guy I think that was not. Forgive me if I'm speaking out of turn here, but was he the first black coach to win the NCAA tournament when he was at Arkansas?
No. John Thompson.
Okay.
John Thompson.
Thompson did it. Did it at Georgetown before he did it. Okay. Okay.
Right.
Gotcha. I wanted 80, to be sure of that.
84?
Yeah. That's about right, because I think Richardson came a couple years after that. But nonetheless, I mean, he had a compadre in a Richardson there at Tulsa, so he had somebody in state that he could talk to.
Right. Those were interesting times. And speaking of interesting times, we have some interesting times coming up in black college football this weekend with the game of the millennium.
The millennium?
Columbus,
oh, please.
In Columbus, Georgia.
Hey, it's going to be interesting. This year, Morehouse has an incredible amount of optimism and steam. Generally, when we play Tuskegee, it's a hope we win type situation. This year we go in with a lot of confidence. The Tigers, I think, are 5-0. Tuskegee is 3-2. They had their big media luncheon down in Columbus today, and I'm quite sure there are a bunch of boasting on both sides. And it's a great event for the city of Columbus. That you know the genesis of it came about when Georgia and Auburn used to play at Memorial Stadium in Columbus. And the black soldiers who were stationed at Fort Benning, which is just south of town, could not go to the game. So the classic was started of Tuskegee Morehouse to fill in that void where giving the black soldiers who were fighting for our country an opportunity to go to see college football. And it has been there. I think this is the 83rd edition of Tuskegee Morehouse. I've played in three of them. My record is 1-2. We won my senior year, and so I got to go out with a bang. And I'm really thrilled about what the Maroon Tigers are doing this year. And it should be really exciting. It's been a week of festivities there in Columbus. And for folks who are within driving distance, drive on down to Columbus, over to Columbus, up to Columbus, to see what should be an exciting football game. And for those who are outside of the distance, and for those, it's going to be on ESPN3 on the Internet. So the game is at 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon in Columbus.
Should be a great matchup. Tuskegee has been struggling a little bit offensively, but defensively, the Golden Tigers are tough to deal with. So I look for it to be a low-scoring game. Maybe probably 20 points will win it. 20 points will win the game. If Morehouse has 24 points in them, they'll be 6-0.
Well, they normally have around 20, so we're going to see where they get the other points from. So it should be a good contest in that regard.
The last couple of weeks has been 23.
Yeah. So hopefully they can pull a little bit more out of that. And I don't have to listen to you for another year talk about a win. Oh,
Tim,
that gets old.
Tim.
That gets
Tim.
Old.
Not me. I'm not like that.
No.
I'm not like that at all.
It must be your evil twin. Your evil twin is doing it then, so I'm going to let that go.
People often get us confused.
That's what's going on. I think also there was, just looking back a little bit of last week, I don't want to dwell too much on that, but there was a big game in Dallas. Prairie View knocking off Grambling, 22-16. It's the first time that Prairie View's beaten Grambling in 3 years, and PV ended Grambling's 26-game SWAC winning streak, which started in 2015. So that's huge news. Some rumblings there on the west side of the bracket in the SWAC, where you look at Southern is not having a good year, Grambling is having an okay year, and now PV's saying that we're somebody to be reckoned with over there.
Well, Prairie View, they didn't just win the game. Really, they dominated the game. I think they held Grambling to 3 points in the first half,
Right.
They didn't really get going until like the fourth quarter when they changed quarterbacks. So, you know, we could be looking at a changing of the guard because, you know, Prairie View with Eric Dooley as a coach, you know, he's a, well, I hate to use offensive genius, but, and I'm not going to call him a genius, but, you know, he has some tricks up his sleeve, you know, everywhere he's gone, Pine Bluff, Grambling, and now at Prairie View, they've had some offensive juggernauts, Prairie View has it going offensively with Jalen Morton at quarterback and Dewanye Tucker, the running back who leads all of Division One in rushing. You know, a little small guy in the mode of Tariq Cohen, who's really getting it done. So they could be the team to watch for the rest of the season. And really, you know, the first couple of games, you know, they kind of let a couple of games get away against Rice, and I forget who the second opponent was. They beat North Carolina Central rather handily in the season opener in the MEAC-SWAC Challenge. So this could be a big year for the Panthers.
Well, this weekend, I guess Grambling gets a chance to get the taste of that loss out of their mouths. They're hosting Oklahoma Panhandle State. So
that's about all
I know. So that's the beginning and end of that. I think it's going to be a big game in the East.
That's probably about 55 points worth right there. You know, Doug Williams may come back and throw a couple of touchdowns, you know, just for old time's sake.
I'm thinking it's kind of early for homecoming. This is the first week of October. So I'm like, yeah, that's the kind of opponent you play. And in the East side, you got Alabama State is at Alcorn, which is a big game on that side of the conference.
Well, it's big. It's really big for Alabama State if they're going to retain any hopes of, you know, championship hopes. They just have to beat Alcorn, which, you know, probably isn't very likely. You know, especially down on the reservation. I don't see that happening. Alabama State is in the midst of a long road stretch. They haven't had a home game since the season opener against Tuskegee, and they won't have another home game until November. So, go figure.
And that's unfortunate because it seemed like after they swept coaches last year, they got hot till the end of the year, and they really haven't won anything at all this year. And they've looked really bad doing it. Alcorn smoked Southern last week 20-3. So, you know, they've got to be rumblers down in Baton Rouge.
There were rumblings in Baton Rouge before the game.
Right.
So, I mean, what comes after rumbling? What's the next step up from rumblings? The Jaguar Nation is very, very unpleased.
They've got to be shooting invectives right now. I mean, they only had 139 yards of total offense last week. And that just doesn't cut it because, you know, the quarterback should throw for that at least by himself. So that's not something that they want to write home about. And I really wanted to do some back research on UAPB and the year that they're having. But, let's not kick a man while they're down. They got beat 56-9 playing Florida International last week. And their defense has given up points in bushels. So that's tough on this side.
They have Bethune-Cookman this week?
Yes, they do. They do have Bethune-Cookman this week.
So
you
have plenty more opportunity to kick them while you're down. They won't be getting up for a while.
No, I'm going to say that again. Now, who just said they don't have Bethune? Bethune's playing Valley this week.
Valley, another SWAC have not. It's so easy to get them confused, you know, when you look at the scores.
We get them all mixed up there.
Yeah.
So we got in the MEAC over there, Norfolk State, they knocked off Dale State, which wasn't a surprise, but the game A&T was able to bounce back from their loss, and they took it out on South Carolina State 31-16.
Well, they were in trouble. They were in trouble in that game for a while. They were down 16-3 late in the first half, and then they finally got it going, you know, got their mojo back in the second half, you know, thanks to the ground game.
Yeah, they got a touchdown just before the half and went crazy.
Right. They got the ground game back, and then that in turn lit a fire under the quarterback who hadn't played well at all this season, and he had a, you know, had a night, ended up having a nice game, and maybe that will be the start of you know, them playing back to the level that they played at the start of the season. But they're still.
But you wonder how could they have a downfall on a game like that? I mean, you look at it and say they shouldn't be overlooking anybody, especially SC State, irrespective of what records are. That's South Carolina State. You respect the name.
Yeah, you respect the name, but you don't respect the offense. They just don't have enough offense. They can't score enough points. Their quarterback situation is not good. And you know, and in today's football, you have to score points to win. The days of, you know, winning 10-3 and 7-0 and 10-7, those days for the most part are gone. Because
it's a shootout mentality.
Everything is designed, you know, the rules and the schemes and everything is designed to put points on the board. And if you can't do that, you know. And it's like Eddie Robinson used to say, it's like the law in the of the Old West, the last to draw is the first to die. So you got to put points on the board.
Well, they haven't been doing that because the state really is surprising to see that they're 0-4 this year. The quarterback, Tyrese Nick, only had 90 yards passing last week, and that's not going to cut it. They're guys who do that on three series in the first quarter. I mean, you look at Alabama and a turnover from their game. I mean, it's just apples to grenades in terms of competition. But I flip over and look at that game, and it's first quarter, it's like 35-0, you know, that kind of thing. So you got to put points on the boards, and people are making statements early on about different things.
Well, South Carolina State, the touchdown they got in the first half was their first touchdown of the first half the whole season. So that's
the whole season. That's hurtful.
Yep. You can't win that way. You can't win at all that way.
Yeah. Well, Morgan comes off of a bye week, and they're going to have them. South Carolina State's going to be at Morgan this weekend. You look at the matchups here. A&T is at Dell State, and Norfolk State's at FAM. Howard is playing at North Carolina Central, and then Charleston Southern is going to be at Savannah State. Savannah State also is having struggles in its final season in FCS, and it's going to drop down, I think, and I'm not sure if they're joining the SIC. I'm not sure if that's official or not.
I don't think it's
but
official, but that's the word that I'm getting. I don't know if they'll return to the SIC will go any better for them than, you know, their first go-round there. They didn't leave with an impressive record. They didn't go out on a high note. But
well, they got better facilities over there now.
But do they have better players? That's the issue. No. But that Florida A&M Norfolk State game, that shapes up as an interesting game because both of those teams have shown some signs of, you know, trying to get it going, and this game is going to will be a big step forward for one of them, whoever can win that game. So I'll be watching that game with a lot of interest. You know, Willie Simmons is, you know, trying to get the Rattlers back to, you know, where they were, what seems like light years ago now when. You know, Billy Joe was there with that Gulf Coast offense and running up and down
right.
the field and throwing the ball all over the place and scoring a lot of points. So that'll be interesting to see. But another game, interesting game, is going to be South Carolina State and Morgan State.
Right.
I don't look for a lot of points in that contest. And if South Carolina State doesn't get the win there, I mean, it's a long season. It's going to get even longer. And I really hate that for Buddy Pough, the coach at South Carolina State, really a class guy, the dean of the MEAC coaches, and, you know, who has had a lot of success, and, you know, he's on a 1-year contract now, so, you know, his future's kind of up in the air. His future's kind of up in the air, and, you know, everybody wants to go out on a high note, and it's just not shaking out like that at this point, so. You know, we'll be watching that one closely.
Well, another thing you'd be watching closely, and I've just realized this is Roscoe, this is Sco and T. Ramon matchup weekend. You got Saturday, you got Tuskegee Morehouse, and Sunday, the Falcons are at Pittsburgh. Your team, your Steelers. I just realized that, and it's going to be, you know, Falcons have broke up. They got a lot of guys. They lost four starters in 4 weeks. I think this is game five coming up, and they will have a fifth starter out. The nose tackle, Grady Jarrett, will miss the game with a sprained ankle. So 5 weeks, five starters on defense have gone out.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb. The final score is going to be 50-49.
I see. You going short. I'll say something like 58-54. Because nobody's going to stop anybody. They got
exactly.
The Falcons have zero defense. They're going to get a couple of offensive weapons back this week. Devontae Freeman is going to be back. And another guy, I think, on the line is coming in. So their offense will be even more potent than what it is. And the Falcons' DBs are hot garbage. So I think your receivers are Smith-Schuster and Brown and this the other Brown, the guy who nobody's ever heard of, number 13, I think that's his number, who looked like a superstar Sunday night. All those cats there are going to, you know, and they don't put any rush on them. You just Ben sit back there and throw the ball. It's going to be something else. The Falcons have never won in Pittsburgh. They have a tie. They've never won in Pittsburgh. So it should be interesting on Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. And I'm sure Mean Joe Green, you know, when he sees the Steelers try to play defense, he's rolling over in his grave. This is very un-Steel Curtain-like, the way they play defense. I mean, it goes back to the Steelers of the early 60s when they had people like Ernie Stautner. And I'm dating myself now. But
you are, because I only remember Ernie Stautner as a coach for the Cowboys, so you really going back.
Yeah, well, he was a 230-pound defensive tackle, so that tells you how far back that was. But they were not a very good team, not a very good team at all.
Go ahead.
Defensively, this Steelers team is kind of, you know, living up to that standard.
Oh, that's incredible to see them play the way they have been. Because I didn't think Baltimore's backs were that good, but they made them look great. So that was something to behold last week. Before we get out of here, we got a couple of minutes left. We got baseball going on because after the Falcons game, if the win or lose, folks can take a chance on rooting for their Braves. It'll be game three of the playoffs, and it's opening round here to be playing the Dodgers. This series starts tomorrow night in Los Angeles. First two games in L.A. Game three is going to be Sunday night in Atlanta, so folks can hang around all day, have the baseball game in the afternoon, the football game in the afternoon, the baseball at night over there. Last night the Cubs lost after leading that division for most of the year. They lost a wild card game in extra innings, 13 innings to Milwaukee. And tonight Oakland's playing the Yankees. Yankees on top. Aaron Judge has hit a two-run homer in the first inning, so there it's right now. It's in the third inning with the Yankees ahead of the A's, and whoever wins that game, I guess, goes on to play. I'm trying to think. They play
Boston.
Boston, that's right. The team with the best record. So they play Boston in that series. You got Colorado and Minnesota. Milwaukee tomorrow, and the Braves and Dodgers start this series tomorrow, and then Cleveland's at Houston. I picked before the season start Milwaukee and Houston in the World Series, with Houston beating Milwaukee in the World Series. Now,
well, I'm taking the Yankees against the field. I'm not a Yankees fan, but I'm taking the Yankees against the field because I hated them so much when I was growing up. I'm trying to, you know, make amends for my deep and abiding hatred for them back in the day.
No, when they stood in the way of the Braves winning only just one World Series back during their run and during the 90s and the early 100s. And so I'm still not feeling the Yankees at all. Matter of fact, I want to see them go down all the time.
So let me ask you this, Tim, being the baseball guy that you are and having,
uh-huh.
having played the game. The Cubs losing, does that mean the curse of the Billy Goat is back?
No, it doesn't. It means the curse of players not performing in the clutch is back. They had a chance in the last 2 weeks of the season to wrap it up. They played horribly. They had a chance last night to win, and they didn't take advantage of it. They got a lot of breaks, i.e., there were some bad calls all going against the Brewers last night. I mean, against the Rockies last night. The Rockies deserved to win because they had to play against really hostile environment there at Wrigley and deal with the fans and that kind of thing. But, you know, we got to wrap it up. We got to go.
That sounds like the curse to me. That sounds like the curse to me.
Well, that goat has revived itself because they won the series 2 years ago. So that's a tough one. But, we're gonna leave it at that and wrap it up. And you know, we'll come back and next week with we hope some things that you guys will really want to listen to and take a heed to. We want to thank Coach Jeffries for his input tonight. So until next week, Roscoe.
Express yourself.
You don't never need help from nobody else. All you got to do now is express yourself. Whatever you do, do it good. Whatever you doing when you're doing what you look like you're doing. Express yourself.